to today, Nick's Cigarette City versus the United States. Mr. Rusnak.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Michael Rusnak, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Nick's Cigarette City, Inc. This appeal is from the United States District Court dismissal of the appellant's complaint for refund of federal income taxes, penalties, and interest for the years 1997 and 1998. Nick's Cigarette City, Inc. is an Indiana corporation and operated a retail outlet in Hammond, Indiana during the years 1997 and 1998 and during the time the years covered by this appeal. It filed its federal income tax returns with the Internal Revenue Service in Cincinnati, Ohio, for both years 1997 and 1998. In October of 1999, the IRS commenced an audit of the taxpayer's 1997 tax return. Shortly thereafter, in November of 1999, the IRS commenced an audit of the taxpayer's 1998 tax return. The audit was a lengthy audit and went on for a period of 14 to 24 months, in which substantial documents were uncovered by the government and in which a number of adjustments were ultimately concluded by the government, and two examination reports that were issued to the taxpayer. In February of 2001, the IRS concluded the examination and issued a revenue agent report setting forth various adjustments. That examination report asked the taxpayer if it would like to respond to do so within a short period of time. The taxpayer, through its counsel, addressed each of those specific adjustments. Shortly thereafter, the IRS issued a statutory notice of deficiency to the taxpayer for the year 1997, giving the taxpayer the right to petition the United States Tax Court within a period of 90 days if it wished to contest the tax. Otherwise, the assessment was going to be made. Approximately a year later, the same facts follow. The IRS concluded its examination for the 1998 tax year. In February of 2002, the IRS issued an examination report to the taxpayer, permitting the taxpayer to submit additional documents or records why the assessment should not be made. The taxpayer responded in a detailed letter to the examiner, giving the reasons why the adjustment should not be made, and that the Office of the IRS issued a statutory notice to the taxpayer for the year 1998, again giving the taxpayer the opportunity to go to tax court or the resulting assessments would be made. Nick's Cigarette City chose not to appeal to the United States Tax Court. Instead, it paid the tax, penalties, and interest, making up the two audits, both for the year 1997 and 1998. Then it later went ahead and filed a detailed claim for refund, both for the year 1997 and for the year 1998. The refund claims were filed with the Internal Revenue Service in Cincinnati. The audits were conducted out of the Maryville office of the Internal Revenue Service. The refund claims that were filed by Nick's Cigarette City attached the copy of the notice of deficiency to them. Part two of that refund claim stated that the taxpayer disagreed with the assessment that was being made pursuant to the statutory notice, and further stated that the income tax reported on the original returns were correct. Notwithstanding that, the Internal Revenue Service in April of 2004 issued a notice of claim disallowance, one for the 1997 refund claim and a notice for the 1998 refund claim. Each notice of claim disallowance that was issued to the taxpayer stated that it was a final notice of claim disallowance, that it had reviewed the taxpayer's case, and that the claim was being disallowed because the taxpayer failed to petition the United States Tax Court.
Now, these notices that are coming in, and you mentioned that the one is, I guess, that the audit was handled by Maryville and the refund by Cincinnati. Are these operating in without knowing what the other is doing, or is it the attorney, I don't know whether it was you or not, is communicating to show that there are two things going on at once? Or are they in isolation?
Well, Your Honor, they're done in isolation, but the tax system and compliance system today is set up for the Internal Revenue Service to know what the history of the the audit and the taxpayer's return and the payments and the credits are being made. In this particular case, however, Your Honor, the refund claims that were filed with the Internal Revenue Service in Cincinnati, there's a stamp in the record. It's noted in the record on page 173 of the appendix, acknowledging that the taxpayer was submitting both claims for the refunds and that the taxpayer disagreed with the exam assessed tax. That was received by the stamp received by the Internal Revenue Service Cincinnati October 3, 2002, at the time both refund claims were filed. So therefore, even though the refund claims were filed with the Cincinnati, properly filed, mind you, at the place that the original return was filed, that the Cincinnati office was well aware of the fact that the refund claims related to an assessed tax and had those claims, refund claims in its possession, and that those refund claims actually attached the notice of deficiency. So it was very clear at the time the claims were received by the Cincinnati office that the taxpayer was making a claim for the additional taxes and adjustments stemming from the notice of deficiencies that were issued to the taxpayer for the years 1997 and 1998. Your Honor, we would submit that although the taxpayer may not have literally complied with each of the requirements under the regulations that state that each claim for refund shall provide in sufficient detail each ground for which the claim should be submitted or is being submitted and the facts sufficient to apprise the commissioner thereof, that the record in this case clearly establishes that the taxpayer substantially complied with the regulations, that the IRS had knowledge of the facts giving rise to the claim, and that his notice of disallowance that was issued with respect to those claims constituted a determination on the merits. This court has, in the past, United States versus Goulding, or Goulding versus United States, and recently in Kikilis versus United States, has acknowledged that under the doctrine of waiver, that where a claim is submitted for refund, and that the IRS has knowledge of the claim and makes a decision on the merits, that jurisdiction exists. More recently, in Kikilis versus United States, this court went on to state that, or to add a provision that says where the where a claim for refund is submitted and the notice of disallowance leads the taxpayer to believe that the IRS treated the claim as formally sufficient, that, again, the IRS shall be deemed to waive and subject matter jurisdiction shall exist. Your Honor, we would submit that those are the facts in this particular case. I would also like to bring out to the court that in 1998, as part of the IRS Restructuring and Reform Act, Congress changed the law to require that the IRS give the taxpayer a reason why the claim is being disallowed. In this particular case, the reason that the IRS gave the taxpayer was illogical and an incorrect statement of law. The government admits this and acknowledges this in their brief. The legislative history behind this provision...
That was that you had to file, had to appeal to the tax court or something, right. Wasn't it?
That is correct, Your Honor. The when the IRS gave this notice, they just included, you should have went to the tax court. We believe the district court judge misunderstood the law. Petitioning the tax court and proceeding to the refund account are two mutually exclusive remedies. You can have one or the other.
So if you had followed all of the precise specificity, et cetera, then that would have merited an appeal to the filing in the district court to proceed.
Yes. You're right. And we did. The taxpayer in this case substantially did comply with those regulations.
Well, that's the question, I guess. It's a question of whether... That's a question of whether or not we have jurisdiction.
Yes, Your Honor. And that is the issue before this case, is whether or not this court has jurisdiction. And under the doctrine of waiver, where the IRS has knowledge of the claim and issues a denial that constitutes a decision on the merits or leads the taxpayer to believe that the claim is formally sufficient, this court has both in Goulding versus United States and Kikilis versus United States has said waiver has existed and the district court has jurisdiction. We're here today, Your Honor, to ask this court to allow Nick Cigarette City's case to proceed on its merits.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Resnick. Mr. Brandon.
May it please the Court, my name is Robert Brayman. I represent the United States. I'm confused by an element of my opponent's case. In the trial court, we really dealt with two questions. First, was the claim adequate? If not, did the government waive its right to insist that the claim be adequate? The district court decided both against the taxpayer. My understanding from reading the appeal brief was that the adequacy of the taxpayer was not raising the issue, not contesting the issue that the claim was not adequate. The only issue on appeal is whether the government waived its right to insist on the adequacy of the claim. I know Mr. Rusnik has gone into some detail about the nature of the audit and the back and forth and what documents were turned over to establish that the government knew what their claim was, and to be sure that information was submitted to the Merrillville office. The refund claim was submitted, as it's required to be, to the service center. The person at the service center didn't have the whole scope of what had happened in the audit, and also the claim didn't specify what exactly was being raised other than everything that happened in the audit. So I believe it's not disputed at this point that the claim itself was not adequate, and we're only talking about whether the government waived its right to insist. I think it's worth actually looking at the notice of disallowance. I'm sure you've done so. It's Mr. Rusnik is correct that I would say it's an illogical and inaccurate statement. The government can, a taxpayer can go to tax court without paying the tax, or can pay the tax and go to district court and ask for a refund first and then go to district court. Read in isolation, this sentence is a true statement of law. Read in isolation. I'm on page 34 of the excerpts of record. Similar notice appears on 58.
34 of what? The appendix?
The joint appendix. The single sentence is, a review of the case showed that a statutory notice was issued, and since you failed to petition the tax court, an assessment was made, and that is how it works. What's wrong with the sentence or the letter is it appears underneath a sentence that says, we can't allow your refund claim for the reasons shown below. That true statement of tax law cannot be a reason why the claim wasn't allowed. He was not required to go to tax court first in order to show up the merits of his claim. I want to compare this case with a few other situations. Perhaps a strong case for the government would be like in the Kikolos case, decided just under a year ago. The government's notice of disallowance said, we can't allow your claim for the reasons shown below. You haven't provided an explanation. You still have time to do so. We need to hear it. And that's very helpful to the taxpayer. It emphasizes the service element of the IRS's mission, explaining to the taxpayer what they've done wrong. One question to think about is the IRS required to provide that explanation in response to an inadequate claim? Or does it waive this defense if it doesn't provide that explanation? And I don't think there are any cases that hold that the government does have to provide that explanation. At the other end of the spectrum are cases where the notice of disallowance says, we've reviewed your claim, we've determined that you're not entitled to this money back, and now you can go to court. And that indicates to the taxpayer that the government has treated it as an adequate claim and denied it on the merits. There's several things in between, and this case is in between. There could be a notice of disallowance that doesn't give any explanation at all. Does the government waive its variance defense when it doesn't provide an explanation because it hasn't told the taxpayer their claim is negative?
But when the government decides to be a traffic cop and sends you in the wrong direction, is that what occurred here?
I think so. I think someone knew they had to provide an explanation, press one button, pick something from a menu, and they picked the wrong one, and it didn't make any sense. miss the taxpayer getting that and reading that with the question is, does that sentence mislead them into thinking that their claim was adequate, that the government has treated it as adequate and denied it on the merits? Is it misleading in that fashion, or is it just signal that somebody screwed up at the IRS and we don't know, you know, it gives us no assurance. It should have given the taxpayer no assurance that they had done everything they needed to do. And it's embarrassing on the part of the IRS that it hasn't gone the extra mile to tell a taxpayer what they needed to do.
What should we make of the early concession by the government's remnant that jurisdiction existed? I know that.
Sure.
Is that another wrong button being pushed?
Well, you know, it's really sort of a very bald admission. You know, the allegation was just the court has jurisdiction under Title 28, Section 1346A1, which is the general jurisdictional statute for tax refund cases. And the government just said, yes, it does. There's no detail about because the claim was adequate, because the claims, you know, met all the requirements. That's just the general jurisdictional statute for tax refunds. So I really don't think there's anything
kind of on the scale that you appropriately set out, trying to place that along with the initial letter.
All right. Let me put that in some context. I read a lot of these waiver cases, and I see essentially three factors that motivate courts to find the government has waived. One is evidence that the government has decided the case on the merits. And there's no one suspects that it did in this case. When the government gives the taxpayer misleading information at a time when the statute of limitations is still open for the taxpayer to amend their claim, which induces the taxpayer to forbear from acting. And the only thing that happened during this window is this letter. And the third thing is extreme delay in litigation. Waiting until after there's been a judgment, an appeal, and a remand. In the Goulding case, I noticed because of the sequence of events, the taxpayer had 2 years from when they paid the tax to amend the claim, and they filed their claim right away, and it got denied right away, and they went to court right away. And so when they filed their complaint, there were still 18 months during which they could have amended their claim, and the government didn't raise this waiver defense until after the 18 months had expired. And under those circumstances, the litigation delay was harmful to the taxpayer. That's not the case in this case, because the statute of limitations for amending the claim expired before Nick Cigarette City came to court. So by the time the government answered the complaint and denied jurisdiction or admitted jurisdiction, it was already too late for Nick Cigarette City to do what it needed to do.
Was there anything that they could have done that, after given that time period, expiration?
No.
Does that wipe it out no matter what?
I'm sorry?
The fact that the statute was run.
The statute ran before they came into court, but after the IRS issued this notice of disallowance. So there was perhaps 6 months after the notice of disallowance was issued that they could have amended their claim and did not.
There was a 6-month time they could have done something, I guess, after
yes.
they got that first.
They could have thought about this real hard, realized something, reviewed what they had done, and filed an adequate claim during that time.
Did the IRS at any point indicate that it considered the tax application refund inadequate?
Did the IRS indicate to the taxpayer that they thought that?
Is there anything we would see that to suggest that?
No. I want to make one last point before I run out of time about the Goulding case, which I regard as a strange and difficult case, probably not a good case for this court to rely on, even though it is from this court and is in this area. In that case, the government conceded on appeal.
How do you feel about Kiklos?
That's a great decision. Great decision. Nothing wrong there. In the Goulding case, the government conceded on appeal that it had waived this defense. I have the brief the government filed from my office neighbor still had and took a look at it. Because the government conceded that point on appeal, there was no, you know, vigorous briefing on this point. Vigorous briefing, as you know, produces the best judicial opinions when things have to be carefully considered, and the court was deprived of that in that case. There's one thing, and I know in the Kiklos decision, Judge Fleming reviewed the Goulding case. But I noticed after reading it a couple times, one point in it that's just really wrong that you should avoid if you're looking at it again. The court there criticized the government for not raising the variance defense in denying the administrative claim. And the IRS normally would not be able to. The variance defense is after the administrative claim when you raise a new point in your complaint. So the government would not normally be able to point out that problem in responding to the administrative claim.
All right.
Okay. Thank you.
If you want to make a concluding remark, I didn't want to cut you off.
No.
Okay. Thanks, Brian. Mr. Rosnack.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, just a couple points here to conclude. The kickless, under the refund rules, a taxpayer can file a timely claim for refund if it files a refund claim within 3 years of the original return filing date or 2 years after the taxpayer pays the tax. In Nicksegret City, for the 97 year, the taxpayer paid the taxes in June of 2001. The IRS denial notice was issued, I believe, in April of 2004. At such point in time where the taxpayer only had a few months to, actually 3 months, I believe, to file a timely refund claim. Secondly, we'd like to point out here, Your Honor, that 6402K of the Internal Revenue Code was passed as part of the IRS Restructuring and Reform Act of 1998. And at that time, it was changed to require the IRS to give the taxpayers the reason why their claim or notice was being disallowed. The Senate report reflecting the legislative history that accompanied that act states as follows. The committee believes that taxpayers are entitled to an explanation of the reasons for disallowance or partial disallowance of a refund claim so that the taxpayer may appropriately respond to the IRS. That's one of the reasons, in terms of whether it's the variance argument or whatever the government's making here. If the IRS would have gave Nicksegret City the appropriate notice that his claim was insufficient, or they viewed it insufficient, then even within a short period of time, Nicksegret City could have went ahead and amended and filed a new claim. Now, we'd also like to point out in conclusion, Your Honor, that this case is substantially different from Kikilis. When the government denied Kikilis' claim, the denial notice told Kikilis that the claim was being denied because Kikilis did not provide sufficient documentation. And it was also instructive that it told Nick and Helen Kikilis that they could file a new claim for refund. None of those things were done in this case, Your Honor. If 6402 has any meaning whatsoever and if fundamental fairness applies to tax administration, then these claims should withstand and in this case should be allowed to go forward. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Rosnack. Thank you, Mr. Brennan. The case is taken under advisement.